two, three. This is Tria Prima, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to Freemasonry and the Western esoteric tradition.
The thoughts and opinions expressed during the show don't necessarily reflect those.
But they might.
But they might.
They might reflect them. Or they might not. They might be our own thoughts.
They might be our own thoughts. But they don't necessarily reflect those opinions or...
official opinions and teachings of...
of the Grand Lodge of... We
whatever yeah. jurisdiction. This is our podcast. Tria Prima podcast, right? So this is the inaugural episode.
First one, yep.
Episode one. And Tria Prima, why? Because there's three of us? What's... the, why?
Dive into Tria Prima a little bit.
It sounded cool and occulty, and I think it was within the purview of... subjects we wanted to cover. It's the three philosophical principles of Paracelsian alchemy, really all alchemy, and Spagyria, right? But it's salt, sulfur, and mercury. You know why I thought it was cool? Was because when we were talking, you know, when we were kind of planning this podcast, we knew that we wanted it to be conversational, and we knew that it would be the three of us, right? Because we had had lunch over it and things like that. And I think it's interesting that, you know, one of us would kind of act as the sulfur, another one would sort of be the salt, and another would be the mercury. And I kind of figured you as the mercurial element,
Pat. I get to be mercury.
Pat.
Yeah. I'll take it.
I don't know. He's pretty salt of the earth, this guy.
He is the salt of the earth. Well, who are we? Who are you, Pat?
I'm Pat. I'm a newly made Freemason, and we all met at Ascension Lodge in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know. Can I say I was made a Mason? I'm not made. What would I say?
You were made an entered apprentice mason.
I was made an entered apprentice mason.
So yeah.
You sure were.
I was there. I saw that
happen. Who are you?
I am Jamie Paul Lamb, and I am a Freemason and an occultist, and I wrote a book a couple years ago called Myth, Magic, and Masonry. Recently, I'm a Facebook star. No, I went on there and I made a bazillion friends recently. Just
because of me, might I add.
Yeah, with everybody who had a square and compasses on their profile pic, or anybody who was a widow's son biker, I basically made friends with everyone. So
fezzes.
Anybody with a fez
on?
For sure. So I sent all Masons and occultists that were apparent per their profile pic a friend request. Many accepted.
That's how you... Wait, really? That's how you chose everyone?
Yes.
You looked for all the people that had a black and white washed out photo where you could only see like half their face.
That's my photo. My 19th century occultist photo.
Yeah.
Who are you anyway? We skipped over you.
I'm Jacob Traer. I'm also a member of Ascension Lodge, a founding member. Jamie and I are charter members of Ascension Lodge. That's how we met, and that's Ascension Lodge senior deacon, soon to be secretary.
So the podcast, this conversational thing, we like the Joe Rogan model better than the one guy sitting there interviewing another guy
thing, right?
And based on, not to get all, you know, meta podcast about our podcast, but why we're doing this, I think, is because we've had so many great conversations together. And Pat, I think you being an EA or an entered apprentice and not necessarily being conversant with a lot of the subjects and learning about Freemasonry and learning about Western esotericism, I think that, you know... you're a great sort of, you're that mercurial element, and you're a great sort of exemplar for the listener who might not necessarily know anything about Kabbalah, tarot, astral travel, 19th century magical orders, you know, Neoplatonism, Hermeticism, et cetera, et cetera. And for you to be sort of that conduit.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I'm kind of jumping in the deep end with you two guys who've been studying this material for so long. But I think every time we get together, I always learn so much. And you always kind of tackle my questions. And I think that's kind of my role is just going to be trying to dig a little deeper and I'm just thankful to be able to get my questions answered about this content.
And keep us on track.
Keep you on track.
Yeah. And I think like Pazuzu, though, in The Exorcist,
can't wait for this.
Well, he mixes lies with the truth to deceive people. And I think that just sometimes happens. Nobody knows everything, right? And I think it's honest to be like, wow, I don't know if, like, for instance, today I got challenged on Facebook. Was Adam Weishaupt a Freemason? And I looked up the quick and dirty on Wikipedia, right? And it wasn't like an argument. It wasn't an uncivil Facebook argument. This was just, I had said, I think he was a Freemason. You know, so and then I looked it up. I kind of backed it up with the wiki thing. Not trying to, you know everything. I'm not trying to, you know, stuff anybody. You know, just like, what's the basketball term? You jam somebody up at the hoop. I'm not sure when one dunks on another.
You jam someone up at the hoop.
A bunch of athletes here.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, sportsmanship.
So at the start of the podcast, we said this is about Freemasonry and the Western esoteric tradition. You guys want to dive in a little bit and talk about, like, what is that? You know, what is that to you, and what's your interest in it, and why are you so interested in it that you want to do a podcast about it?
Well, I think it's super convoluted to start with because there's a lot there. Western, as to separate from obviously the Eastern or Oriental traditions, you know, mystery traditions, which I think Jamie already kind of touched on, but essentially are things like the tarot or Kabbalah, whether it's Christian Kabbalah or the original, arguably Hebrew or Jewish Kabbalah or modern Hermetic Kabbalah, and potentially even new subjects that maybe we haven't even thought of that might come up, like what you, I think you even mentioned, astral projection. Yeah. Or meditation.
Does like modern alchemy fit into that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, or just alchemy in general. I think alchemy is, well, alchemy kind of spans the world.
Oh yeah, there's Indian, Chinese alchemy.
Yeah. So,
you know, one thing you were just kind of touched on there was you could tell a lot about a person by how they spell Kabbalah. You ever notice that?
Mm-hmm.
If they're Cabala, they're probably into Florentine Neoplatonism, right? They're probably or like sort of Renaissance
Christian.
German. Yeah, exactly. And with a K, they're generally like full on Judaic, right? Kabbalah, right? And then with a Q, a la Paul Foster Case and Crowley, and I think even Waite, and they're generally in the GD or post GD Golden Dawn,
right?
Tradition. Hermetic Kabbalah, that sort of syncretized system that included Egyptianisms, Enochian,
right?
Theoretical and practical magic.
Probably important to note that too, because probably I would say that we will be taking the Hermetic Kabbalistic
We're
approach.
Q all the way.
Yeah, probably.
Wait, we are Q means something.
We are Q.
No, there's some.
Yeah, let's not go there.
Yeah, okay. Q is a thing.
There's Pat.
Pat's name is out there. He's going to get doxxed.
So anyways, yeah, I think if and when we touch on Kabbalah, for the listener's sake, it's will more than likely be from the Q point of view, Hermetic Kabbalah or GD, post-GD.
And so what does that mean, though? I mean, what, like, where...
So the Kabbalah can... I think this is kind of the best way I heard it, or at least the easiest way to kind of conceive of the Kabbalah, because it's such a... There's so much. And it's across multiple cultures and continents, and there's just a lot to digest. But in general, it gets easier to think of it as like a filing cabinet, right? And if you picture, I guess, the Etz Chaim, which would be the tree of life. Which is the glyph that is most central to Kabbalistic theory.
Post-Kircher.
Kircher really codified the tree as we know it. It's changed here and there. The pathways between the Sephirot have been argued upon and disagreed upon. But anyways, if you think of Kabbalah like a filing cabinet, a lot of people and multiple cultures have added, you know, files to that cabinet over many, many years, hundreds of years. So the Hermetic Kabbalah, I think, is probably the most prevalent to what we're doing, because it encompasses there are more files kind of in that cabinet to include things like tarot or other perspectives, right, that we think might be analogous or sympathetic to the current or older files that have been in that cabinet, right? As where maybe the Jewish Kabbalah just stops at a point, and they really have their attributions or whatnot.
I frankly don't know a whole lot about just straight up Judaic Kabbalah with a K.
And
we lived in West LA for a bit. There's a gigantic Kabbalah center there, like Pico and Fairfax or something.
Yeah, Madonna's over there all the time.
I think Madonna's in there.
Yeah.
But, Pat, I mean, before this, had you heard anything about Kabbalah, or was it that's like Scientology?
I think I had mostly heard about like the Jewish Kabbalah, the Hebrew Kabbalah, but I didn't realize that there were different kind of versions of that. Like, I didn't know there was a Hermetic Kabbalah. It's been interesting to learn. It's been kind of a whole new fascinating way of thinking and being kind of introduced to the Tree of Life. And that's definitely a thing that starts to kind of change has changed my thoughts about kind of, you know, these larger ideas.
That's great, right? Because it's an organizational principle, right? It's this chassis upon which, or it's a foundation upon which you could build other concepts or constellations of concepts, right? So I think that's huge in itself. And it's like, you know, I often think, or, you know, I talk with other people interested in the occult or Western esotericism, and it's always, why do we do this, right? Is it just some geeky pastime where we're just like, geeking out on the material because, A, we think it looks cool, and it does look cool. Occulty stuff looks cool. It's attractive, right? Tarot cards old woodcuts and weird plates and frontispieces from...
Fascinating aesthetic to it all.
Exactly. The aesthetic is great. But I believe that, and everybody probably figures this out for themselves, and I thought to myself, like, why am I investing so much time in learning the theory behind this stuff and learning, you know, these abstruse sort of systems, archaic systems, and, you know, things that seemingly have no bearing in the modern world other than talking points with somebody else who's a geek about that stuff, right? But I have found that for me, it is a valuable frame of reference, and it promotes an active sort of meaning making in my life. So when I, you know, in my experience of the world, it really enriches that. It really enriches incoming information, because, like, say, mythology. I think that's a perfect analogy, right? So the more you know of Hesiod and Homer and Pindar and Ovid, etc., if you know all the personas and all the narratives, or some of them, you know, if you have a good handle on classical mythology, you will never watch even something like Bugs Bunny, let alone Star Wars, the same again.
Absolutely, those traditions, those mythologies are so prevalent in modern media.
It's archetypal.
Yeah, it's archetypal. So
the same stories are told again and again and again, just in different ways.
Absolutely. And I'll echo what you're saying. I think that being able to map out the meaning of things is, to me at least, and probably to a lot of, I guess, air quote, initiates or whatever, is more important than just the objective or seemingly objective reality that's in front of us. Like, the more important or the greater aspect to the things that we go through in our mundane life or whatever is figuring out the meaning behind it with respect to our experience.
There's a depth.
Right.
That's inaccessible without certain maybe interpretive keys or...
And we map that out every day, you know, for better or for worse, right? We have a narrative every day that, or over the course of a week or a year, or multiple narratives that are always going on in our lives. And I think that generally the Western esoteric tradition and its kind of tangential studies and systems heighten that ability to create meaning in that narrative or narratives that you play out every day.
I guess one of the things that I keep thinking about as I'm diving into all of this is that, you know, any thought that I'm going to have is probably not an original thought, because there have been people for centuries upon centuries that have been asking the same questions, you know, asking about how do I live a better life? What comes later? What is the meaning of everything? And it's just so enlightening to kind of dive into some of this work and then read all these other interpretations of that. And there's just like such a body of work that you can, it just gets your mind thinking and gets you going down a road that maybe you wouldn't have found on your own, you know?
Yeah.
I think it might be interesting to just get a quick quip from each of us about our first kind of encounter with occultism, or what maybe seeded our interest in this type of thing. Do you want to start, Jamie?
Sure. So we were living in Minneapolis. This was 2006. And we were living in Northeast, or Northeast, they call it, Minneapolis, kind of a blue-collar area, very Eastern European ethnic area, very close to downtown, right across the river, the Mississippi River from downtown. We were living there. We loved the area. We were there for 4 years while my wife was doing graduate school. But so it was an artsy area because studio space was cheap still at that time. I doubt it is anymore. But we found out there was a flyer for a film festival, and they were showing Hodorowski's Holy Mountain and the short films of Kenneth Anger, or Anger, however you say his name, Anger or Anger. And I had heard of both of them just from cinema stuff. You know, I happened to be, I was interested in that. So I had heard both their names. So I went to where they were showing, and they were showing at Leaping Laughter lodge, Ordo Templi Orientis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in a in a an art space in a warehouse. So an old, you know, an old 19th century late 19th century warehouse space that had been sort of cubed off for various.
It's a cool setting.
Yeah, so I went. I went, and it was strange because I didn't know anything about anything. I had read some Lovecraft. I had read some of this and that, you know, but Arthur Machen maybe and things like that. So I know I had heard like Golden Dawn before.
Right.
Because when I was sitting in there watching the films, I was looking around and I saw what I now know to be a Tree of Life and other emblems that I'm conversant with now. You know, I remember looking at those and it's a clear thought that I had. I was like, this seems like Golden Dawn sort of stuff, is what I thought. And I guess I was sort of close looking back now. And then it just kind of, you know, we had a Masonic lodge right around the corner, Arcana Lodge on Central and I think Lowry or something in Northeast Minneapolis. And I would walk by there. It's always been sort of an interest. I like that it was secretive. You know, I like that these things were sort of occult. They were hidden.
Yeah.
You know, and that was attractive. And of course, like you were saying, Pat, the aesthetic of the whole thing. You know, weird diagrams and glyphs and astrological stuff. It was just attractive to me. But let me just qualify that for a second. Just because it's aesthetically pleasing and just because it's attractive superficially, I think that in itself is not superficial, because there's a reason why if these images speak to us, it's not merely the veneer. You know what I mean? There's something that's speaking to us at a deeper level that draws us to these things. So yes, if you are interested in old alchemical codices and the art, you know, the artwork inside of them, and you're interested in, you know, pentacles and weird goetic sigils and things like that, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a superficial interest. You know, that's just the thing that's kind of pulling you in, and who knows at what level of your personal unconscious or even the dialogue with the collective unconscious that's just impelling you or compelling, I never knew the difference, impelling or compelling you towards something that's going to hold deeper meaning for you.
What about you, Jake?
The aesthetic really was appealing to me as well when I was like a young teenager, you know, 14 or 15, middle of high school. I remember taking this trip. The class was Human Geography, and we went to San Francisco for three or four days, and we did a lot of walking around, you know, downtown San Francisco and kind of just analyzing the cultural kind of imports that San Francisco had, right? So that was kind of the point of the class. But I remember walking past, and I don't know what, it was a huge building.
Knob Hill, right up Knob Hill.
Yeah, I don't know if, is that the Grand Lodge?
That's the Grand Lodge
in
California.
Yeah, it's in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, at the top of Knob Hill, I forget what that street is.
And it's got a massive chapel across from it. But those two things were like blowing my mind. So we were walking down the street, and I saw the giant square and compass on this, you know, what I now know to be the Grand Lodge of California, and then this like Gothic style or whatever it was. I can't quite remember the behind me, that chapel. And I looked it up that night during the trip. I was started digging into it, and I had heard of Freemasonry before, of course, from movies or whatever. Da Vinci Code stuff, or good old Nick Cage, National Treasure, right? But that was the extent of my knowledge. So I dug into it, and I was able to see past the, you know, the kind of conspiratorial element pretty quickly. I just didn't slip into those ideas easily like a lot of people did. The alluring thing to me was the mystique and the aesthetic. But I knew nothing of like the philosophy or really what, you know, Freemasonry offered to men. That kind of sparked the interest for me. And over time, throughout high school, I got more into philosophy and history and those things. And Freemasonry kept popping up. So Freemasonry was my in to occultism, I guess. You know, I started with Freemasonry. And I became a Mason when I was 19. And that was 2013 or 14. I became a master Mason. And then from there, just meeting all the brethren, right, that had so much to offer, and all the different kind of topics that they were interested in were super interesting to me as well, because I was just like this young kid, right, and all these older guys were like sentient beings to me. But it really wasn't until maybe just like 2 years ago or so where I really started to dive deep into kind of the Western esoteric tradition and occultism in general, things like the tarot, Kabbalah, and stuff like that. But Freemasonry was definitely my in.
Yeah.
Pat? And that's been my in as well.
Yeah.
Is I think I just kind of hit a certain point in my life where I wasn't totally satisfied with the answers I was getting from religion in general. And I was searching for more knowledge, you know, trying to understand myself more. The whole idea of like, know thyself, you know, going on that journey of like, okay, let me really figure out who I am. Let me really figure out what I think, and not just kind of what's been told to me over years. And I found Masonry, and one of the things I really liked is the idea that it's a group of guys, but it's, you don't have to buy into one particular religion. You don't have to buy into one particular set of like political beliefs. It's all just very much like, okay, come as you are, and you be you, and you accept me for me, and then we'll just kind of learn together. And all the symbols, I just think there's such a rich collection of material that you can just really like, you could spend a lot of time on one little detail, and it just kind of
lifetimes on,
yeah, it just goes so,
right,
deep
on singular subjects.
Really. And so that's kind of what's brought me into it. And I got into tarot a little because I just like the stories that you can tell with the cards.
Yeah.
You know? I think it's amazing that somebody so long ago figured out all of the different aspects of being a human. And all those cards are so universal, you know, at any given point, we've all been every one of those. And so,
you're echoing something Eliphas Levy said. I can't quote it verbatim, but he said, if a man was, completely isolated and all that he had at his disposal was the, a deck of tarot cards, he could, I forget what the product was, but he could sort of figure out the mysteries of the world and become, and gain knowledge, mm-hmm, simply through the archetypal images in the tarot cards.
Yeah. It's amazing that it's like early psychoanalysis almost.
Yeah.
Where you're able to really kind of see where you're at by looking at a spread. And, I'm not of the mind right now where I'm thinking it can like predict my future, but I'm of the mind that if I look at a spread of tarot cards and really spend some time looking at like a story that's told there, it'll help me tackle a problem or a situation in my life from an angle that I wouldn't have approached it without having done that. It kind of opens doors in your mind to other possibilities or other points of view.
Your foreshadowing episode too.
Am I foreshadowing episode two?
Yeah.
More to come on that later.
Yeah,
more to come on that.
Yeah. Episode two is exactly about tarot, yeah. Huh? Hey, you know, you also left out my favorite part of your story. I know this part of your story where you were interested in Freemasonry. You contacted somebody at the Arizona Grand Lodge. They said, come go to X address and meet this person there. And
so I was, you know, I was.
This is a great story.
Do you know this one?
Yeah, oh, yeah, this is a great story.
I was interested in Freemasonry. I think I was like 23, 24 at the time. So that was a while ago. And I was like, well, I don't know any Masons, but I guess if you're going to ask somebody about it, you kind of go right to the top, right? So I emailed, it was the head Mason in Arizona. And he was like, emailed me back, yeah, why don't you come meet with me at my business and I'll tell you about Masonry. So,
well, you could say, no, I like when you say what it was. It was a dingy apartment complex on Van Buren.
Yeah,
yeah, color the story a bit better for us.
Don't
spice rack this story because it's a good one.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, so I'm looking at this address, and this is like before Google Maps and stuff. So I'm driving down Van Buren, which is kind of a rough part of Phoenix.
Right.
And I get to this really seedy hotel. It was a seedy hotel. And
you avoid stepping on all the syringes and used condoms.
It was, you know, out by the airport, and I'm thinking, this has got to be wrong, you know, and I double check the address. I'm like, no, this is where he sent me. Okay. So I go in and,
you're thinking, is this the Grand Lodge?
I'm thinking that maybe I'm being messed with or, you know, that it's not a,
or it's some like Craigslist scam.
Yeah. Right. I wrote the address down wrong or something. I go into the front desk and he's like, oh yeah, come on back. And I get brought back into this this little office library, and
who's in there?
Me and Rex Hutchinson have a
Hutchins.
Oh my Rex God. Hutchins.
Oh man, I hope he never hears this.
Yeah. Well, Rex Hutchins.
Have a nice long conversation about
a bridge to life.
About Freemasonry.
Pillars of wisdom.
That was the first Freemason I ever met, and.
That's crazy, though.
That is crazy.
To walk into a seedy hotel, get led back to a weird nook of this place in off Van Buren in Phoenix, and who is it? Rex Hutchins,
the sitting
Grandmaster of Masons in Arizona.
Yeah,
and if you know Rex Hutchins, you know he's like quite a personality.
Yeah.
So I guess he. He owns the place. I think he owned the hotel, and it might have been like kind of an apartment complex / hotel. But it was.
I can imagine the room, right? That office, what it must like a 2x4 fluorescent lay-in.
I can
fixture.
Smell it. Right.
I can smell.
I can smell that
with
place.
One of the tubes. One of the fluorescent tubes is blinking.
Flickering.
Right,
and it's he had flickering. His shoes off.
His shoes are off.
His shoes are off
under the desk, though, so you can't tell.
Right. Yep. But they were off.
But they were off.
There was a cigarette lit, but he didn't touch it the whole time.
Right.
How
Venetian
long did you...
blinds?
What's that?
Venetian blinds?
I don't remember.
Probably 130 degrees.
I think it was the summertime, so that would make
sense.
I just
love that story.
So the first time I met Rex was down in Tucson, and... he found out at the time I was at the Polytech campus at ASU for physics, and somehow I don't know if that came up in conversation, like another, I don't think I brought it up. I think someone else did, just to kind of like see what would happen there, you know, cause Rex is, or was an educator as well. And, I went to shake his hand, and the first thing that he said to me is, I don't believe in black holes. Just to my face, as to try to like arouse some sort of like argument or something out of me. But that was the first thing that he ever said to me. And then we went into Lodge That was my...
I wonder if his business card says that.
I don't believe in black holes. But then we went to dinner afterwards and had a great conversation. And, like, he says that, but...
But he does believe in them?
But he... Well, yeah, there's a lot more to, you know, unpack when he says something like that.
Yeah.
But we had a great conversation. I sat next to him, we had a few glasses of wine and talked about black holes for a while.
So... We had a great conversation, but when I left, I had realized at the time that it was too much of a probably a commitment for where I was at in my life. So I kind of put it in the back of my head and promised myself I'll revisit this some other point. And so about 10 years later, 10, 12, maybe, oh my God, maybe longer, I got to a point where I was like, okay, I can do this now. And that's when I started kind of attending lodges and eventually heard Jamie Lamb on the Whence Came You podcast and heard he was in Phoenix.
Thanks, RJ Johnson.
And I was like, I gotta meet this guy. And that's how I found Ascension.
Yeah.
You sure you weren't hearing the Tria Prima podcast from like another dimension?
From the future?
From the past? It might have
been.
Future?
It might have
been. You went back to the future and heard your own podcast.
Wow.
Episode 400.
Can I do my Rex story?
Yeah.
It's not as good as yours, but it was when I was finishing up my manuscript for Myth, Magic, and Masonry, and I wanted Rex to do the foreword. I knew that I was just jumping headlong into the jaws of the sea monster shark, right? And so I sent the document to him, like a Word document. We talked on the phone. And I sent him the document with kind of a thing saying, hey, I would love for you to read this. And perhaps if you find value in my labors, you will contribute a foreword, right? And I quickly got a response back. He was like, call me at da 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 da. So I called him up and he was like, well, why do you want to write a book? And I was like, well, I have all these papers and I have all this stuff and I just kind of worked it up into a manuscript. And he's like, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to say? You know, what are you trying to add to stuff? And I told him what I thought some of my novel points were and what I felt I had to offer, right? And then he just came back and sort of like, I think we had another phone call a little later. Okay, I'll read it. You know, and then we talked again a couple weeks later, and he was like, okay. And then he had this laundry list of things that I needed to do first to the manuscript, which basically involved taking it apart almost letter by letter and rearranging it completely. And I was just like, oh my God, it was like done when I gave it, as far as I was concerned. So I didn't want to do that, right? I just wanted to get this off of my plate. I had spent a lot of time on it. It was my first publication, you know. I wanted to get writing on something else. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so I ended up having to say, you know, I can't do it, you know. But I did end up sending him a copy of the finished book, and I wrote in it, Rex, I know I didn't take your advice, et cetera, et cetera. I hope, you know, this one's for you, whatever, this is your copy, et cetera. But the thing was, is Rex, yes, if you know him, you know that he has kind of maybe a gruff demeanor, right? But there are few people who I think have the level of knowledge and the level of expertise, you know, and who are able to convey this information and who are diligent and who are also, he's very humble in a way, right? There are few people who I find those qualities forgivable in, and Rex is one of them. He could almost do anything and he's still, you know, he's earned the right to be kind of abrasive. Does that make sense? Does that
totally? He has. I wasn't
I'll take his abrasiveness before I'll take somebody who from somebody who I don't respect as much.
Sure. Yeah, I wasn't like mad or anything when he just, you know, the first thing out of his mouth to me was some sort of thing to try to
challenge get you.
Yeah, he was challenging me, but I knew why. I didn't think he was just trying to be a jerk or, you know, like, who's this kid? Because that wasn't what he was doing. Right. And oftentimes it's not. Oftentimes he's very Socratic. You know, he's like, tries to...
A gadfly.
Yeah.
Like Socrates.
Yeah. Very much so. All right, so I want to kind of bring us back a little bit to
Tria Prima.
Yeah. I want to talk a little more about why we started to hint at it, but you know, my whole thing was I've thought about doing a podcast before, and you said the Joe Rogan model, which is something we're trying to kind of emulate, right? More of a conversation.
Not an interview.
Not an interview, but more of a, you know, back and forth. Or
basically a public version of what we do when we go to lunch.
Absolutely.
Or when we go to dinner.
And we want the listener to be able to kind of be a fly on the wall for the conversation, as where it might sound, you know, if we were just reading a paper that we did, or, you know, if it was just one of us. It's a little harder to make it through an hour of that type of thing and stay excited about it or something. Mm-hmm. So when the three of us kind of came together, the first three.
Tria Prima.
Yeah. It just made sense to me, and I was more willing to jump into something like this because I think it makes more sense for a listener.
It's philosophical, too, because of the... like a Hegelian dialectic, right? You need those three parts. You need the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. And I think those sort of correlate or are analogous to the three philosophical principles per Paracelsus, which are salt, sulfur, and mercury, right?
The Tria Prima.
Exactly. So you know what's another thing? I always go back to this article that was in, and I forget the brother who wrote it, but it was in Knights Templar magazine about 2 years ago, maybe as much as 3 years ago. And it was about corn, wine, and oil. So do you know that was in the first degree lecture, I think, right? Corn, wine, and oil? No.
I think so.
No.
No.
No,
I'm thinking that's chalk. Another one. Chalk.
Yeah, chalk, charcoal, and clay.
Charcoal and clay. Yeah. Well, it's no big secret that corn, wine, and oil are wages.
Wages.
Right. So these are wages that craftsmen were given, operative stonemasons were given, and probably people in other guilds or everybody, right? So around the time that... you know, the sort of architects of our ritual, people like Preston, I guess, Anderson, Webb, whoever was around at that time. It's not my forte, knowing that stuff. But around that time, so late 18th century, or sorry, early 18th century, corn would have meant salt as well. So, yes, it would have meant the grain, corn, maize, right? But it also meant corn as in to salt something, like to preserve meats, like corned beef. It's salted beef. So to corn something is to salt something to preserve it. And so that automatically makes it salt, wine, and oil, let's say, right? Wine... is so the salt you already have, that's the salt modality, right?
Right.
Wine is a spirit, right? It's alcohol. So wine is the mercury of the grape. So the mercury of a substance in Spagyric alchemy, which is Kingdom Vegetalis, right? It's vegetable alchemy. The spirit of something, or the mercury of something, is the alcohol content after fermentation. So that's where you get the wine, right? And in fact, wine and its further distillation, brandy, were used in medieval alchemical operations. Before, you know, things like grain alcohol and, you know, none of that was around. The furthest distillation or the most premium distillation, I guess, would be brandy at that time, which is wine, burnt wine. In fact, brandine, I think it is. I forget the etymology, but it means burnt wine. That's what the word means. So that's your mercury. And then the oil, because if in spagyric Paracelsian alchemy, if you distill the essential oils out of a root, a stem, you know, leaves, the flower, etc., of a plant, you are extracting the sulfur element. So that's the sulfuric modality as the essential oils, because oils burn. I guess it has something to do with the fire, the fiery element, right? So there you have corn to salt. So you have salt there. Wine, you have the mercury. And oil, you have the sulfur.
Body, spirit, and mind.
Exactly.
Right? And yeah. Or body or soul.
Or soul. Or soma, pneuma, and psyche. Right. Or corpus, spiritus, and anima in the Latin. So there that three part sort of division.
It's apparent all over the place, especially in alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
And we even had a brother we mentioned the chalk, charcoal, and clay.
Mm-hmm.
We had a brother write up a paper, maybe sometime.
At Ascension?
Yeah, maybe sometime we... Yeah, Danny. Maybe sometime...
Hawkins?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe sometime we get him up to talk about that. But he likened those also to those three, mm-hmm. you know, base elements.
Yeah.
That are essential for... that are essential parts of an alchemical process.
Now, that's the thing. Are they elements or are they modalities? I guess they are the elements, right? They're the reduced sort of tripartite elements of the one.
Sure. Let's take a spagyric. Let's get specific. So, let's talk about if we did a basil.
Cilantro. Basil.
Like a basil spagyric. Literally the alchemy.
A tincture.
Yeah, a tincture, let's call it, right? So, and I'm not an operative alchemist, so I'm sure I'll get corrected maybe online, or Jamie, correct me on the fly here, but you've got
prima materia.
Your prima materia, which is your basil leaf or whatever, and you've got a whole grip of that, and you need your alcohol, your spirit, right? And you heat up your spirit.
Wait a minute.
Right?
No, you take the basil leaves and you dry them. There's a quick method and there's the long method where you're actually fermenting the alcohol out of that prima materia. And that one I've never done. I've always, because you can use, there's a quick method where you use grain alcohol. Now, there's no fault in that because that grain alcohol is a universal vegetable alcohol. It comes from grains, right?
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so if you dry your basil leaves and put them in a jar, let's say,
yep.
and then you cover that, like, say, a half an inch or an inch or something over the basil leaves mm-hmm. with grain alcohol, the oils or the sulfur... Yep. will leach out of those basil leaves
right.
into the alcohol,
into
your
the
mercury.
Spirit.
Yeah. So there you have the sulfur and the mercury mixed, right? And then you pour that through then you wait 40 days if you're going to do an alchemical month.
Month, right? Yeah, 40 days.
And then you pour it through a muslin cloth, and what's in into another jar, right?
And then burn off that leftover
mush,
yeah,
right,
to get your salt,
right? So you burn that down to ash, and hopefully you can get it to white ash, right? Mm-hmm. And then you put that in like a petri dish with some distilled water,
mm-hmm.
and you let it evaporate,
And that's when it starts to crystallize, right?
If you're lucky, I've never gotten it to do that. I've only done simple method tinctures, you know? But I'm sure that is, yeah, I think that's the potash, right? That's what they call the potash or the potash.
Right. And then finally, you kind of add them back together, no?
Exactly. So you take those purified and Solway, like as in Solway et Coagula.
Right.
You've separated the salt, sulfur, and the mercury, those three component parts of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
You've separated those, you've purified them via an alchemical operation on each of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get them in their purified form, you combine them again, coagulate, back into a purified tincture. And that is a spagyric tincture that contains the salt, sulfur, and mercury of, in this example, basil.
Wow. Right? So that's all to say, that's an argument for their elemental quality, like, right? But we could apply, we could say that they also, I mean, you were beginning to almost challenge, I feel like, me saying the word element.
No, I think they're more elemental than what we think of as the elements, because if you look at fire, water, air, and earth, those are states of elements, right? Because fire, what they call it now, it's the what do they call it, the matter, the states of matter. Mm-hmm. So fire is plasma, it's referred to as plasma now. Water is of course liquid, air is of course gas, and earth is a solid. So you have a solid, a gas, a liquid, and a plasma as states of matter. So it seems to me that what anciently those Empedoclean elements were actually the states of matter, not matter themselves, not elements themselves.
Okay. Yeah.
But states of the elements. And those elements, we can consider those as, you know, the tria prima.
Mm-hmm.
Salt, sulfur, and mercury of whether it's in the mineral kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, or the animal kingdom. All three kingdoms in which you can perform alchemical operations, right? There's theoretically a salt, sulfur, and mercury to each of those things. And they exist in states of matter, which are what we call the classical elements, earth, air, fire, water, you know, which are really just states of matter. Does that make sense?
I think so. I think I was following.
There's a lot there, but I think to tie it back to our name and why this podcast, I guess, became Tria Prima is not so much necessarily their elemental quality, but I think that we wanted to kind of... I think we're more analogous to the to those salt, sulfur, and mercury as we were talking about earlier with, you know, body, spirit, and soul. I think that we kind of operate on certain...
Three planes.
Yeah, three planes of... yeah, sure. Well, if we tie it back into the Kabbalah, right?
Worlds.
The worlds, right? And when we're doing stuff like this, we kind of operate. When we have conversations like this, we're kind of operating on a higher plane than your mundane kind of experience, right? And a big part of, I think, the at least for me, the esoteric traditions is to kind of heighten not only a setting like this, but your mundane experience as well, right? To raise kind of your general level of awareness to a higher plane of consciousness.
Yeah.
Or and to make those elements of yourself more in sync maybe with each other, or your awareness of those elements of yourself is heightened. Right.
Oh, for sure. I see what you're saying. Yeah, so that's a classic sort of hermeticism, right? Where you're operating on this plane, you're thinking in these terms, you're using these modes of figures of speech and these models to talk about things and to absorb and communicate information. And if we're using these modes and models and this vernacular, then we're literally changing the way we process information. So there's that micro macro kind of, you know, we're thinking in this way, and it's an organizational principle within our minds, vis-a-vis synaptic connections, however it is that, you know, I'm not a neurologist, but I know enough to know that we blaze trails in our minds, or in our brains, rather.
Which very much have an effect on our physical reality.
For sure, and our outward expression, right? Things that we're able to manifest in the world, which is magic.
Which, that's one of the kind of hermetic principles, right, is the mind preceding matter universe, rather than, you know, the matter preceding
idealism.
Mind universe. Right. Or mentalism or whatever you want to call it. Not like the...
You're doing a Kabbalion thing. You're getting PFC.
PFC.
Yeah.
But
I think... What does that stand for, anyway? Paul Foster Case.
Paul Foster Case. Great guy.
Yeah.
And brother.
And a brother.
And a brother of ours.
Yeah. In fact, when we moved to L.A., I affiliated at... the lodge he was, I affiliated at South Pasadena 290, which absorbed Highland Park Lodge. And I lived in Highland Park right up the street from Bodotown.
Wait, you're saying that's where Paul Foster Case was?
Well, he was made in Long Island somewhere. Freeport, I think, is where he was made a Mason. But of course, he was out in L.A. doing his Builders of the Atom deal.
Right.
And
him and Ann Davies.
Yeah.
He was also a musician.
Yeah, he was a band leader, I think.
Yeah.
What's next? What's next on the agenda?
Well, I think we
got a few minutes left.
Do we? We have a couple more minutes left.
No, I mean, what can people look forward to?
Oh man, so we've got the next episode. We'll be talking about tarot and kind of diving deep into that as much as we can, and. After that, I'm not entirely sure.
At least somebody's on point. You're the guy. You're the. You know how in Joe Rogan, he's got Jamie, who's doing all the stuff, who's very tech oriented, and he could source information very quickly and stuff like that. I feel like you're the Jamie of our thing.
I think we were going to talk down the way. We've got tarot. We've got kind of Rosicrucianism, Kabbalah. We just talked today about Kabbalah. The K, oh, yeah. C, or Q.
Yeah, we could certainly, we could talk about all these topics for like multiple episodes.
Yeah.
I think it'd be great to hear you talk about Baphomet, because you've got a cool talk that you do on Baphomet.
Well, Jake just read Twyman's book.
Yeah, Tracy Twyman's Baphomet.
Yeah.
Cool book.
Rest in peace, Tracy. Well, seriously.
Rest in peace. Don't even laugh
when I say that. Rest in peace, Tracy Twyman.
Rest in peace. But great book. The margins are a little weird.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying... And the lines aren't justified. Like,
no.
The paragraphs are not justified. That drives me crazy.
Yeah.
If you're
a little hard.
If you're Lulu publishing a book or anything like that, get somebody to format it. You know,
Thick book, too.
It's a thick hardcover book.
It is. So it's a lot of...
And you don't justify it?
Yeah, well...
You don't do the simplest thing you could do in Word with literally one key click?
Good book, though.
Let's end this one on... what are you guys reading right now?
Oh, I'm reading History of the World by... I think it's J.M. Roberts. Literally, the History of the World. It's a Penguin edition. It's about 12,000... Or, sorry, 1,200.
It's 12,000 pages.
No, it could be. It's the history of the world. It is 1,200 pages. So it's a fat paperback that I'm reading. Yeah.
I always kind of have like three in rotation at one time, but I try to do one audiobook, and then I've got like two physical books that I kind of trade off throughout the week. The audio book I've got going right now is Maps of Meaning.
Peterson.
Yeah, Dr. Jordan Peterson. That's a thick guy. It's about a 30-hour read. And then I've got Hermetic Masonry.
Frank C. Higgins.
Yep. And I'm still finishing Baphomet, so I haven't quite...
Which one are you listening to?
Jordan Peterson.
Oh.
I enjoy that because he reads his own books. sometimes it's hard to listen to...
His Kermit voice. Yeah.
But he's acknowledged that he has a Kermit voice. And no, it's good. It's a good book, especially for a lot of what we were talking about earlier. I think it's a super applicable. I think a lot of Masons would enjoy.
And that's his first book before he got tangled up in his identity politics stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's not even really...
There's no political stuff. I mean, there's a little bit in the introduction. There's a little bit of him kind of going throughout his life's history and where he was at. But it's not laced with, you know, like a political undertone or anything like that. What about you, Pat?
I'm finishing up a Carl Jung book on archetypes and the collective unconscious.
Wow. So that's heavy, man.
Trying to dive into that a little bit.
Heavy.
You're going to just dive into that? Just kind of... I have a hard time
It was hearing it. You guys talk about it, so I was like, all right, I think I need to read some Jung.
No, it's great, but it's almost impenetrable. I almost prefer reading his commentators, like Von Franz and people like that, Jacobi, because they seem to clarify it a little more. Reading him directly is like you have to cut that stuff. You know, it's like...
Well, then it's all been translated from German too, right?
No, I think he wrote in English.
Did he write in English?
Yeah. Okay. I think, well, I'm not sure if his first stuff he did, but later I know he was writing in English.
Okay.
But it's pretty impenetrable.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where I'm reading it before I go to bed, and it's, you know, you read it, and then you read it again, and you read it again.
And you still don't fully grasp it.
You don't fully grasp it, but it gets me to sleep really quick.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Well, I think so. I think we should wrap it up with actually potentially asking the listeners to share their opinions, hopefully. Give us some feedback, maybe some topics that they would like to hear. I'd love to see that kind of thing from the audience. Any suggestions on things we could talk about?
Yeah, we need the website.
Yep. We're still working on that website to come, but we have an Instagram account.
We've got an Instagram. Let me see where the underscores are. I believe it's Tria_Prima_podcast. Cool. There's some photos on there already. Go follow that.
I think Jake by the time. Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. Slide into our DMs.
What the heck?
Hit up Jamie on Facebook because he's a star on Facebook now.
Well, I've got.
He's got over 100 friends.
I've got almost 2,000. Oh, I'll have you know.
I like how Jamie hit me up for Facebook advice when he started to make a Facebook again.
I don't even get
on Facebook anymore, but you're doing pretty well. Yeah. So anyways.
I'm crushing it.
You're crushing it.
More than I've got. So
I think our website will probably be up around the time that this is posted, though.
Yeah.
So we'll have all that going. Follow us everywhere. And we'll be publishing some papers, too.
Sounds good. Website. Talk to you soon.
All right. See you guys.
Thank you.